Fala galera, quem tá falando com vocês aqui é o Edu Giansante e esse é um episódio especial de Carreira no Exterior. Ele é parte de uma série nova que a gente tá fazendo, então você vai ter aqui algumas entrevistas, bate-papo e muita dica de galera que trabalha fora. Maioria brasileiro, mas eu vou também trazer alguns gringos aqui para você treinar o seu inglês, né? Por que não? E gente, esse podcast ele é patrocinado pela EduPro, EduPro Academy, que é a nossa academia online de carreira no exterior. Então se você tá interessado em trabalhar fora, quer ingressar no mercado de trabalho, quer descobrir como é que funciona, entender mais da demanda que tá rolando. E às vezes você tá numa transição de carreira, às vezes você tá buscando uma coisa nova, às vezes ainda não tá muito claro o que você precisa, EduPro Academy é para você. A gente já tá com inscrição aberta para a próxima turma de imersão e também temos a mentoria para vocês. Entra então em edupro.academy, você já vai ficar sabendo de tudo que tá rolando, das próximas datas, já se inscreve e a gente vai se ver então na nossa ou imersão ou na mentoria. E é isso, gente. Valeu! Fala galera, beleza? Tô com mais uma entrevista para vocês. Essa entrevista assim é uma pessoa que eu admiro muito, que é o Alex. O Alex ele é talent resource, ele é recruiter, ele fez já um monte de coisa, trabalhou no Dropbox comigo e agora eu vou falar inglês porque obviamente ele não é brasileiro. So Alex, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for your time. Would you like to give like a quick intro on who is Alex?
Absolutely, Edu. Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here. So Alex is my name. I live in London now. I guess I describe myself as a startup and scale-up people and talent person. I really love the energy that comes with building companies from small stage to a much larger stage, all the things that can go wrong, helping to direct the next chapter of sustainable scale is something that I really enjoy doing. Aside from that, big fan of craft beer, big football fan, unfortunately Sunderland AFC is my team. So if you've got a Netflix subscription, you've probably seen my team, Sunderland Till I Die, doing their thing, going down the leagues. But yeah, I love what I do. I live in North London, and it's a pleasure to be talking with some folks who hopefully want to learn more about the world of sourcing, recruiting, and how to position themselves as a great candidate in what is a really interesting market now.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thank you so much for the intro. I've always been a fan of Alex and your style, like, you know, how you conduct yourself, you talk to people, and there's like a way, like how you can keep people feeling like, I don't know, they're like important. Maybe there's a way in how you talk to them, which is really nice. I remember hearing you on the phone, you know, at Dropbox, like sourcing candidates and always being so good at selling. And that's probably like the first question I wanted to ask, because coming from the craft beer world into like recruiting, how do you end up like in tech, and how did you end up with, you know, sourcing, recruiting? Was that like the first choice of your life? Did you like, yeah, I want to go for recruiting, or that just landed on your, you know, on you as an opportunity? How did that start?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's funny that you mentioned craft beer, yeah, because the craft beer scene globally is all about the people. Yeah, it's all about the relationships. It's all about the kind of the good vibes and the energy. And while it sounds a bit cheesy, I do think that the world of recruiting and people and talent stuff does orient around a lot of similar vibes. You know, it is all about the people. And I think it's nice for me to hear you remember kind of the way in which I talk to people and hopefully make people feel valued and excited and interesting about roles or about the company or about themselves, because it's just genuinely about talking to people on the similar level, having good energy and making sure that you add a human touch to it. A lot of the world of corporate recruiting has become incredibly robotic and very formulaic, and everyone feels as if they're part of a conveyor belt. So it's good for me to hear that. But back to your question. It's interesting. A lot of people say that they fall into recruiting because they needed some quick money or otherwise. I'm actually not one of those people. It was more of a decision that I made. So I did, I was at university in Dublin. I went to Trinity College and did a languages degree in French and German. And then, you know, from there, I was thinking, what am I going to do next? And I did a business master's there. And during that business master's, I was very focused on talent management and human resources. There were a few really interesting lecturers on those topics, and I got really into it. I found it really fascinating, the sort of the bridge between business psychology and, you know, interesting stories about companies scaling and the cultural side of scale. How do you make sure that the wheels don't fall off when your car's driving at 100 miles an hour? And I found that absolutely fascinating. And from there, it was just tremendous timing. I graduated from my master's degree literally in the same week that Dropbox announced that they were opening up a European office, a headquarters in Dublin. And, you know, the stars managed to align and I managed to get a couple of conversations lined up. And even though I hadn't got any formal recruiting or talent experience, I somehow managed to blag my way in. And about a month later, I was across in San Francisco onboarding as one of Dropbox's first recruiting staff members outside of the US. So that's how I got into it. And it was just tremendously good timing, to be honest with you. But it was a decision that I made, something that I knew that I'd be interested in. And what, you know, nearly 10 years later, here I still am. So it's good.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And mentioning timing, and you said that you didn't have the formal experience with recruiting yet. You got, you know, to the right people's eyes, and then you got in yourself in at Dropbox. What did you think were, you know, attributes you had? I mean, you obviously said you love this, you know, conversation and people, but there's obviously more to that in how you sell yourself. And what did you feel was probably something that, you know, got your attention and essentially got you the position at Dropbox?
Yeah, I think it's across all different roles, regardless of how much experience that you've got going for a job or how much you don't have. Doesn't matter what the industry or the role is. I think it's always about, do you as a candidate truly understand the need of the business to which you're talking? And the need for Dropbox was, how do you scale fast and keep a culture and evolve that culture? And for me, you know, it was something I was able to put a lot of thought, a lot of research, and a lot of my passion into. And I think that word passion is really important, especially when you're looking at roles within more modern companies and companies that are scaling very fast. You can't do any of it without that passion burning inside of you. So for me, it was really about thinking, well, okay, while I don't have any formal experience on paper, i.e. I haven't scaled a company myself before, I've got lots of thoughts and lots of, you know, potential ideas about how I would do it and how I would help to do it. And I had a strong sense of values and morals and how important values and morals are in the creation of a culture to make sure that everyone feels as if they're part of a very inclusive environment. So for me, it was, while of course it wasn't easy, it was something that I found, you know, relatively fluent when I was talking about it. And I think that really helped because I was passionate about it. And I meant what I said. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't bullshitting people. It was very clear that, you know, I was speaking the truth and speaking from my heart. And that, to be honest with you, was the key thing, I believe, that swung it and got me the job.
Awesome. That's amazing. And that's absolutely right. I remember, like, motivation, like this real passion was one of the drivers. And it tends to be, because if you're not vested, I mean, there's no point in hiring someone who has maybe the skills, but not necessarily the same, you know, passion. And it's not going to go too far. And actually, since you mentioned, like, you got started at Dropbox when you were, like, literally, I think you were the first batch of hires, right? Like, really, like, at the very beginning.
Yeah, we were. It was literally in a tiny office space, and we're still building office furniture and taking IKEA trips. And it was to see what the company's become nowadays, and, you know, one of the biggest brands in the world. It's hilarious to think how small it was when we started off. So yeah, it was really early days.
Yeah, I remember, like, you and John, a couple of people saying that you guys, part of your welcome package was like a furniture, like the IKEA table, to assemble and then figure it out.
Build your own table. Yeah, that's the one. That's the best way to onboard people. Yeah, it was. It's exciting though, man. It's so energizing when you feel like you're joining something at the very start of a journey. And yeah, I was just super lucky to have the opportunity.
And something that, I mean, I'm curious about, because obviously, as you said, like, you're new to all of this, company's growing, and I'm pretty sure there's a lot of ambiguity, things that are not sorted out, no processes in place, and you had to go in and help hire people, like, okay, go find the talent and bring it in. How did you, like, I mean, how did you figure this out? Like, did you have, like, training? Did you just do, like, your own thing? You start, like, Googling it, like, let me just jump on LinkedIn and go full throttle LinkedIn. How did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a collaborative experience when you're hiring for roles, and it's the recruiting team member, the hiring manager, the head of department, and having a lot of deep conversations about what we need from a skill set point of view. You know, what are the hard skills and the experience that we we desire and what are we looking for. But then actually, you know what, you mentioned the word ambiguity there. And so much of it, in my personal opinion, where it comes down to startups and scale-ups and quickly growing companies, is analyzing, does someone have a tolerance of ambiguity? Can they manage to stay cool, calm, and collected when things get a bit crazy, when shit hits the fan, when the wheels start falling off? And, you know, are they okay operating in an environment where they're not going to get told exactly what to do, when they're not going to have a menu of options ahead of them, when they have to figure things out for themselves? And I think, you know, it's a very particular type of person who wants to embrace the ambiguity and gets excitement from it rather than anxiety and nerves. And so when it did come down to it in terms of searching for people who were going to join the business in those very early days, that was a huge, huge factor of, is someone tolerant of ambiguity, and can they, you know, off the back of that, feel energized to get their sleeves rolled up and actually get stuff done? Because that's so important. It's not one of those huge multiple thousand person companies where things just move anyway, and if you do your work or if you don't do your work, it doesn't matter, because you're a, you know, a small piece of a big machine. When it's a smaller business, every person's work matters. Every single person's work matters. And so you need to make sure that every single person that you bring in feels that same sense of ownership and desire to work and to work hard. It's funny, because a lot of people think that the world of scale-ups and startups and technology in general is super easy, super enjoyable. It's just like going to the play park every day and playing video games and just enjoying themselves. Yeah, there is a little bit of that, more so than working for a bank, but it's hard work, man. It really is. You know, you work long hours, hard, crossing time zones, and you find people continuously putting in 12, 13, 14 plus hour days just to get things done, because there is no larger infrastructure. There's no safety net. There's no, you know, multiple team members. Oftentimes you have one person being a team, you know, and in other companies that team might be 10 people, but in a startup it's one. And so that person needs to manage somehow to steer through the ambiguity and do 10 people's work. So there's certainly that to analyze and to make sure people feel excited about that, rather than like, oh my God, this feels so overwhelming, this isn't for me. And it's fine, because, you know, some people do not want to be in that environment, and more power to them. It's not for everyone, but finding those people that do, that's the secret sauce.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think there's one, like, especially if, like, at that time in Dropbox, as an example, it's a company that's well known now, and it was always well known in the United States, in California especially. But then when you're like in Ireland and then trying to source, and then you have just this tiny office space, I'm pretty sure it's not only like, I mean, you can use the brand name, but just a certain extent, because there's obviously, there's not a lot there. And then you had to source people, and you probably were given targets. So like, okay, you need to help, like, get this pipeline here. So maybe there's a 2-point question here. First is like the difference between being a sourcer and just a regular recruiter. Like maybe is the difference that you're like more proactive. You have to go after them rather than waiting for them to come to you. And the second would be what were the challenges you had, apart from, you know, as I said, the office furniture and all of this set up and not having processes, but the actual sourcing and the actual trying to, you know, get them to the door to go through an interview, because people may think it's always like the candidate who goes after recruiters or companies, but it's quite the opposite sometimes in startups, because you want to bring the talent that are not necessarily looking for jobs, right? So how like did you deal with that?
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, how do you manage to activate people, and, you know, for folks who are very happy in their current employment, how do you start having conversations with them and, you know, begin the journey of convincing them that they should have a think about more conversations with your company? So look, back to your first point of the question, the difference between sourcers and recruiters. In larger companies, they are two different roles often, and the sourcing team member tends to be more like a headhunter in traditional ways, going out to market and being proactive in the way that they try and find talent. So as you mentioned, looking at the full talent market via LinkedIn or Stack Overflow, GitHub, or wherever the source of candidates is gonna be, and trying to map out the market, see who's doing what in which business, see who on paper at least fits the criteria that we're looking for, and then starting to reach out to those people in a very personalized way to try and, you know, initially get them on an introductory phone call. You know, no pressure, no need for any kind of formality, but just an initial opener of like, hey, how are you doing? Just hoping you might have a couple of minutes for me to talk to you about what we're up to and what our journey is looking like at Dropbox, for example. No pressure, no strings attached, just want to kind of let you know, and then maybe we can grab a coffee in a couple of weeks. And it's that kind of longer tail strategic pipeline building game that the sourcer tends to do, whereas a recruiter in a larger company tends to be the one that manages the active candidates. If we think about the previous comment being passive candidates, people who aren't actually currently looking for a role and don't really want to interview in a formalized way for your business, that's kind of the world of the sourcer. The world of the recruiter focuses more on the active candidates, people who have been through, for example, that sourcing workflow and go, yeah, I would like this job. I would like to be considered. Let's have some proper conversations. Usually, that's when the recruiter comes in and starts to manage the hiring process from that first phone interview all the way through to, you know, whether there is an offer that gets extended or whether the candidate gets rejected. That's the world of the recruiter that works there. Now, however, in smaller businesses and more in startups and scale-ups generally, that role tends to be combined. And, you know, I am personally of the opinion that it should be combined. You know, I talk about, you know, the candidate journey and the candidate life cycle quite a lot in the work that I do professionally. And I really think that having that touch point and that relationship being consistent all the way through the process of having the person that initially reaches out to you, for example, say, hey, look, I'd love to grab 10 minutes of your time for a virtual coffee just to, you know, shoot the breeze and tell you a few things about the roles that we have open here. Having that person lead you all the way through the process until you get an offer. It might be 3 months, it might be 3 years, who knows what that process looks like. But having that consistency can be super important. So that's kind of my take on the differentiation between sourcer and recruiter, and you know, why personally in the world of startups and scale-ups, I think it's important that these roles are blended. And then looking at, you know, the Dropbox side of the question of how did we actually go about getting in touch with people? I think it was a really interesting story to tell. You know, as you mentioned, the brand was recognizable. Everyone knew the little blue box, but everyone thought like, hey, that's just the thing where I store my photos. And so it was about how do we change the narrative to be something a little bit more interesting of the journey that's ahead. And looking at the time of, you know, several hundred million people globally using this B2C product, how do we think about, you know, pitching that narrative of like, well, okay, we've got our foundations built, the fun now starts because we've got all these customers and these B2C customers. How do we go after the business to business space? How do we think about, you know, the paid product? How do we look at scaling things up? And for me, the most interesting part that I found when talking to potential candidates was the what comes next. I'm thinking that a lot of companies try and start something like this from scratch, but Dropbox wasn't starting it from scratch because they'd already spent the hard years building out that B2C free audience and that brand recognition. And so that was a really kind of compelling narrative to tell people that got folks really, really interested, especially on the commercial and the sales and the marketing side of things, because I think everyone finds that a really interesting challenge in the world of technology and software. How do you change from being a free product to a paid product, from a customer as a B2C product to a B2B product? Those journeys don't come along too often successfully. And so that was what a lot of the talking that we did was, and what a lot of the really interesting conversation came out.
Nice, very good. And I mean, knowing you, I'm pretty sure you had like your own twist to the approach, the pitch, and you probably had like different pushbacks from people as well. You mentioned that a pipeline could last even like a year or more. Like, I mean, what was like probably like the hardest pitch you had to make, and did you bring like someone that you're like, oh my god, I would not expect this person to come in, or the other way around, where you probably got surprised by, you know, some elements of your pitch that worked or didn't work? How was it like your own Alex crafting your pitch?
Yeah, I mean, any good recruiter will tell you that it's all about personalization. You know, you can't have a one size fits all pitch. It's like a sales process. It's like, you know, getting anyone to buy anything. The more personalized it is, the more it resonates with the person in question. So initially, a lot of that comes down to research, whether it just be like a 30-second look at a LinkedIn profile and finding something that we have in common, like maybe it was a university, maybe it was somewhere that we'd lived before, a previous role, a connection in common, a talking point to kind of break the ice. The last thing that you want to do in any of these types of conversation is just dive in with a sales pitch. Everyone hates that. You know, even, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, people hate that. People hate that more than ever now in terms of people just spamming and just talking about sales pitches all day. So it's about trying to find that common ground and you know, going back to the very start of this conversation, you know, the experience of working within the craft beer scene, you get very good at just in 10 seconds building a rapport with someone and talking about, you know, even just corny stuff like a joke about the weather in Dublin or whatever, something to break the ice. And then you can start to pivot the conversation gradually and in a non-aggressive way. Super important. So for me, going back to kind of the more kind of structured part of the question of the Dropbox experience and the difficulties that we had, it links to the fact that it was at the time very much a business to consumer product. And a lot of my role involved trying to hire people who were going to do strategic and enterprise sales, so business to business sales. And as everyone knew at the time, it was very difficult because one of the major pushbacks from potential customers looking to buy Dropbox was, why would I pay for it when it's free? And trying to pitch the value of like, well, okay, I know that there is a free Dropbox out there, but this paid for Dropbox, this is the collaboration tool that you've been looking for. And having someone who's able to have the courage and to spend the time having those conversations where it's not a transactional sale, or at least it wasn't at the time. I think it's a little bit different now because people know that Dropbox is a collaboration platform rather than, at the time, it was just somewhere that you stored your photos. And so for me, that was a lot of difficulty trying to hire very, very senior salespeople who, you know, were getting paid lots of money selling big enterprise software products for much more reputable, albeit less kind of exciting brands, you know, the Oracles and the Dells and the IBMs of the world. Tremendously successful businesses, obviously, but in a very different field to Dropbox at the time. And so having those conversations and trying to find people who were going to get excited about the challenge and the journey ahead and would also kind of add positively to the culture and be able to tolerate the ambiguity, as we talked before, that was the most kind of difficult piece of the puzzle, I think. And then, you know, finally, there was the desire for different languages and different, you know, cultural abilities when it comes to selling and trying to find language and territory specialists who were resident in Dublin. As we all know, it's very difficult. You know, Dublin's wonderfully multicultural, a multilingual workforce resides there. But when it comes to very, very senior level, it's lacking in comparison to going, for example, to Stockholm to hire a very senior Swedish speaking account executive. You're going to have much more joy and luck finding one of those in Stockholm than you are in Dublin. And so that was definitely something to navigate in the earlier days when Dropbox were trying to keep everything in one spot in Dublin. But then looking at the kind of the talent market and looking at advice that we were able to collectively get from candidates and the market and the statistics out there of where does this talent live and reside and work, the kind of the route changed and we started to evolve and build smaller offices in key locations so we could hire that talent in their home location rather than trying to lift them across to Dublin or find, you know, the very kind of rare talent that's in the Dublin market. So that was definitely a challenge.
That's a really good point. It's funny how like it has changed suddenly now to, well, you can do remotely, right? You can go on exactly. And have like your home office. And yeah. Now, let me shift gear a little bit and evolve into like Alex from 2020, maybe not even 2020, maybe Alex from last year, because you went on your break and you went traveling. Yep. What was in your head? And like, did you feel like, okay, it's time for me to take a break after my PhD in talent and resourcing and recruiting? And did you go like on your own? Did you have like a passion to travel before and you just decided to get like a year to do that? How was it?
Yeah, I had an absolutely amazing year last year. And it's funny. It's not funny. It's crazy, actually, looking back now that we're all kind of stuck in our houses during lockdown, thinking, my God, 12 months ago to the day I was in Guatemala or wherever. So look, I guess it goes back to what we were talking about before of working in the startup space, as I still do. It's very, very tiring. It's an exhausting, mentally draining place to work. It's very inspiring. It's incredibly fun and energizing. But after a while, it does start to take its toll. And so I really felt after several years of feeling like I was going at 100 miles an hour to step back and take a break and take some time for myself. So I went traveling for 6 or 7 months with my partner, Charlotte. So we did a tour of the Americas. So we did a lot of road tripping around the US, went through Mexico, went through Guatemala and Colombia, and then back up into the States and finished up in Canada. So we had a great time. And I just think it reaffirmed to me how important it is to take a step back from the craziness. And, you know, especially as we mentioned, in this remote first world that we're currently living in and that will continue, it's very difficult to take a break because, you know, hey, I'm in my house here. I'm at a standing desk in one of my bedrooms. It's very difficult to get that divorce from work and from home because work has become home and home has become work. And, you know, last year really taught me about the importance of being able to switch off and, you know, understanding that it's actually not as easy as people think to switch off, especially with the multiple communication tools and platforms that we all are signed up to now. There's noise all day long. So how can you take a break and how can you take a step back? But honestly, man, I think it just came at the right time for me. And I came back, did a little bit of consulting work with a couple of companies, and then went back into the full-time permanent role that I am now with Cutover here in the UK. And, you know, I felt really, really energized this year, even with all this pandemic craziness. I still feel better than I have done for many years, which is crazy, really, to think, given the scenario. But that break did a good piece of work for me. And I will definitely be recommending a 6-month break to anyone who asks me.
Amazing. I actually have two questions on that, because maybe the first is more on the Alex personal / professional level. How did you feel you changed after this break? Because you were like in a 14-hour day, yeah, craziness, madness, ambiguity, like figuring things out, where now you're like in a really good position, like in terms of career. You're like, you got yourself up into like a really high level. You have like a strong CV, and you had a break that made you kind of maybe rethink about several things. How is Alex now? Like, how are you feeling now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, for me, the word is perspective. It's a cliche. You know, everyone says that when they go on a break or even a vacation for a couple of weeks, new perspective. But it's true. You know, I think I've learned to let go of lots of the things that would previously stress me out, to worry less about what other people think, to have more confidence in my own opinions and my own desired way of working, and to feel more empowered to, you know, for example, taking breaks is a good one. You know, we've got a fully remote workforce currently at my company, and, you know, I have no second thoughts about putting in a 2-hour block in the middle of my day saying I'm going to go running or I'm going to go and have a walk around the local park, and just to have that calendar be respected by everyone, and for me not to worry is that, oh my God, I need to be online at 8 a.m. and I must stay online until 8 p.m. to feel as if I can kind of pivot to being more output focused. You know, it doesn't matter where I am or how long something takes me to do. It's the quality of the work and the enjoyment factor that I'm focused on. So that's something that's really changed for me. I'm definitely feeling a much more comfortable version of myself since taking a break, which is great. And, you know, I'm really glad. And it's funny that you never realize when you're in the middle of a scenario that's not ideal, you never realize that it's taking its toll on you until you get out of it. And now looking back at the Alex that I was 1.5, 2 years ago, it's like, my God, that guy was stressed, you know, like I was really stressed. And, you know, I hope in a couple of years time, I'll look back on the Alex of 2020 and think, oh, that guy's got things in a nice balance and is feeling good about things. So, yeah, so feeling good about it.
That's good, man. That's good. And a more technical question to the kind of like you being like a you know, like in the talent world, you had a career break, and a lot of people think that career breaks may be negative to their CV because it looks bad. You had like a 6-month or 12-month sabbatical or time off? And you're like, how do you justify that? Was it an issue for you at any point? Did you feel this was even more like more powerful than having, you know, an ongoing career? How was that like, you know, perceived by the market for you?
It's funny, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because I think there are two different types of people who, when you talk to them in an interview, for example, about a career break, there's two different reactions. There's people who have been on a career break before and are like, wow, that's a really good call. I'm really glad that you did that. That sounds amazing. And there's people that haven't, that often ask you questions out of jealousy. And it's those people that sometimes don't understand or pretend that they don't understand because they haven't done it or they haven't had the courage or the ability to do it yet. So, you know, for me, I never had any issue because I was confident when presenting the facts. And, you know, I think looking at mental health being a key part, you know, I was more than happy to say, and I still am more than happy to say, that my mental health was suffering towards the end of time before I took this break. And that was a big reason why I did. I needed a break because I was feeling super burned out and I couldn't do my best work. And, you know, if in an interview, if you say something like that and say, look, my mental health was suffering, I took a break for 6 months to re-energize and get some perspective back. If the person interviewing you doesn't agree with that or doesn't like that, then that's not a person you want to work with or work for. Simple as that. And so I think it's you know, a big part of finding jobs and career opportunities is about the values. And do your values match up with the people that you work with and the employer that employs you? And in a scenario like that, it's quite clear that there's not a match. And so that's not the right opportunity for you. Whereas if that company is like, I'm so glad, Alex, that you decided to do that for yourself and felt empowered to take that break for the good of your mental health, then there's a really good match of values there. That's a good sign and should be something to explore more. So yeah, I it's funny. I know that there's a lot of differing advice on how to explain CV gaps, as they say. But for me, it's about the story. It's about thinking about your resume, your CV as a full narrative from day one through to the present day. And it's about how you tell that full story together and how it all fits together. It's not about the component parts in my mind. It's not about what you did for 6 months, 3 years ago. It's about the full story and how you're growing and how you're developing and how you're keeping yourself as engaged as you can. For me, as a recruiter, that's the most important thing. And, you know, going into, you know, a slightly linked point that I think about and talk about a lot of folks who've got more traditional mindsets have in their mind an idea that you must be at a company for a certain amount of time, otherwise, you know, something looks weird or something looks crazy. And so everyone's like, hey, you must be there for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, or whatever else, otherwise it looks like you're job hopping, which is the classic kind of our parents' age type of approach to looking at career paths and CVs. Whereas for me, in my opinion, it's the story that you tell about the time that you have at a company. And personally, I would much prefer to hire someone who's been at a company for 6 months and has an amazing story of what they achieved in that 6 months and a reason for wanting something new, rather than someone who's been at that same company for 6 years and doesn't have a story to tell. Being at there 6 years and say, hey, yeah, I just cruised by, I coasted, no one fired me, so I stayed around. Now, that's not the person that I want to work with. The person I want to work with is someone who's, you know, did an amazing project for 6 months and, hey, look, job's done. I'm onto something new. I made my impact. And so that's something I would really, really recommend to anyone when, you know, entering into an interview process or thinking about their resume or their CV. It's about the story that you can tell, not just about the dates or the names or the numbers. While those are important, of course, it's not as important to me as having that really great overarching story and narrative that you can tell.
Amazing. I love that. I'm a big fan of storytelling. I think for everything, if you tell a good story, it can be compelling, it can be catchy, it can be meaningful, it can bring context. It's everything combined, right? It's amazing. And kind of like, as part of like this, like towards like, we're getting to like our 45 minutes of the second half. I wanted to hear, like, when you're talking about, you know, people getting your attention, you mentioned that the story is more important, but obviously that makes, that's like a step after you got through your maybe CV or you accepted your LinkedIn invitation or something like that. So how can someone get your attention? Like, now that you have like such, so much experience, you've dealt with different nationalities, different types of industries and job types and levels, what things or what attributes, sort of what kind of approach gets your attention? And you'll be like, I want to talk to this person.
Yeah, I think while you're right, storytelling only comes out fully when you're talking to someone. There's a lot of storytelling that your profile can do, whether it be your LinkedIn profile, whether it be, you know, a Squarespace site, whether it be a Twitter account. And it's about making sure that you put some thought and effort into the story that you present to people and the way in which you personalize and bring you out into your profiles. And, you know, there are loads of different pieces of advice out there on how to personalize your LinkedIn profile, how to make it stand out. And there's a lot of good advice out there. But for me, it's making sure that you don't feel as if you're lying to yourself on the profile, that you're not putting, you know, corporate jargon in there for the sake of it, that you're not overinflating role titles, and that you're being honest about who you are and what you do. And what you love to do as well. You know, I think so many people forget that a LinkedIn profile should be a profile. It's not a CV. It's not a list of things. It's something that should reflect you as a human, you as a person, you as a professional, and all those things are linked together. And so if you love football, put that on your LinkedIn profile. You know, tell some stories. If you're an average guitarist, say it. You know, if you know, just make sure that you don't fall into the trap of trying to appear like everyone else appears and trying to be copycat, because there are so many LinkedIn profiles out there in the world, whatever, 700 million of them, that it's very, very easy to be unrecognizable and to feel as if you don't stand out. Whereas a little bit of personality here and there can go a long way to catching the eye of a recruiter at a company and wanting to take that first step to click one time more than they otherwise would. Because that's the journey that you're going on. You're trying to get down the funnel and you're trying to have a conversation with a human. And so everything that you can do to speed up that process and to increase the chances of that human that you want to talk to clicking on you, taking another click, following a link to your Twitter profile, laughing at a couple of your tweets, going back to your LinkedIn profile and going, hey, I might give this guy a call. That's the kind of journey that you want to take people on. And that's the storytelling that you can do by just putting a little bit more thought and personality into your social profiles.
Amazing. I love that tip. And it's so funny how when you say that, I remember exactly the day I was hired at Dropbox, and it was the week of my birthday. And yeah. Dropbox used to send sign cards by everyone in the company with sign cards. Yeah. Because it was my birthday, you probably won't remember, but I think you helped, when was it? I think you helped Chloe find some beers for me, and he had like this pack, or maybe it was Chloe, Fiona, and you got me like a package with like a couple of beers inside this like welcome bag. And I was like, whoa, man, this is amazing. And again, you're talking about like a company hiring you, and then here's like a couple of beers for you because it's your birthday. Yeah. This is so personal, so amazing. And it's that small touch, right? It's like much better than sending me like just like a t-shirt saying Dropbox. It was so much better to me. I felt like so more connected with that. And you're right. It's the personality. It's bringing that natural, this really like human value to it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's that's the thing. At the end of the day, it's the human value that people remember. It's the small things that make a huge difference. It's not about what was written in your offer letter and your contract. It wasn't about the computer that you had or the software that you're using. Everyone recalls the small personal things that really kind of brighten up their day. And if you can manage to do that and to focus on that, then you're going to be so far ahead of the broader crowd that are trying to fit into the boxes. It's unbelievable.
Amazing. I love that. Alex, thanks so much for your time. I actually want to give you space to share a little bit of where you are now, what are you up to, what's next for you, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
Absolutely. If I want them to find me, of course you can find me. So look, I'm currently working for a really interesting company called Cutover. We're based over here in London. We've just raised our Series A funding round with Index Ventures. So it's a really exciting time of growth ahead for us. We're about 80 people now spread between London and New York. And obviously, you know, we're fully remote as most people are, and we'll probably stay that way for quite some time to come. So location means very little now. Enterprise software is what we do. We sell to mostly large financial services institutions, really interesting platform to help companies with big transformation and change. I've been really, really impressed in the 6 months that I've been here with the team that we've got. The leadership team is exceptional. The culture is very diverse, incredibly forward thinking. We've got a real nice range of ages, which is an interesting thing to say because most startups are super young and the average age is in their 20s. We've got from youngest 21 to oldest 66. And everything in between. So for me, that's a very nice new experience for a company this size to have age groups spread that far across the generations. And for me, that's where learning happens and that's where kind of exciting diverse cultures are. So a large part of my next few years is going to be helping to build out Cutover, growing us through the funding rounds, helping us get to 100, 200, et cetera, people. We're always going to be looking for talented people on the commercial side of the business, software engineers and product managers too. Find me on LinkedIn. Always happy to connect with new people and chat things through. And I'm there for the community. If you want any advice, any guidance, I'll do the best that I can. I often do webinars and various other podcasts and things like that. So if you follow me on LinkedIn, you'll be able to keep updated with things that I do. And if you do like your craft beer and otherwise, find my non-professional Twitter. I'll let you guys sort that out. That's much more of a beer-related Twitter account than a recruiting-related one. So I'll let you take a choice of which one you follow.
I love that. I love that. Thanks again, Alex. Thanks for your time. And wishing Cutover and you all the best. I'm pretty sure you guys are going to grow a lot. And I'll see you coming back as a VP of talent somewhere big, or maybe a big crafting duo brewing, something like that. There's something about to come, I'm pretty sure.
Thank you, buddy. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, man.
Cheers.
E, gente, esse podcast ele é patrocinado pela EduPro, EduPro Academy, que é a nossa academia online de carreira no exterior. Então, se você está interessado em trabalhar fora, quer ingressar no mercado de trabalho, quer descobrir como é que funciona, entender mais da demanda que está rolando, e às vezes você está numa transição de carreira, às vezes você está buscando uma coisa nova, às vezes ainda não está muito claro o que você precisa, EduPro Academy é para você. A gente já está com inscrição aberta para a próxima turma de imersão e também temos a mentoria para vocês. Entra então em edupro.academy, você já vai ficar sabendo de tudo que está rolando, das próximas datas, já se inscreve e a gente vai se ver então na nossa ou imersão ou na mentoria. E é isso, gente. Valeu!